Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Today we start off with a discussion with paleontologist Dr. Ed Landing about global hyperwarming and his proposal that rising sea level is a even stronger control than CO2 and greenhouse gases on the near future global temperature rise.
Next, we discuss with Sarah Palmer protests on healthcare that will take place in Troy on Thursday.
Afterwards, we'll talk with Blair Horner about the 45th anniversary of NYPERG and the upcoming 2019 state legislative session.
We then have a segment from Andrew Lynn about the planned demolition of the Mount Ida Dam in Troy. And then we finish up with a farm bucket segment from Dave Pablo, exploring the issue of where we're going to put the Troy Farmers Market and what's going on with the Monument Square. But first, let's start off the show with some headlines. Youth climate activists with the Sunrise Movement and Justice Democrats were arrested on Capitol Hill Tuesday for staging a sit-in at the Washington, D.C. office of Representative Nancy Pelosi, who is expected to serve as the next Speaker of the House, to demand that congressional Democrats back a Green New Deal. A Green New Deal would combine actions to address the global climate crisis with policies to create jobs and a more just economy.
Two retired Troy City detectives were given conditional discharges Tuesday, 4 weeks after they pleaded guilty to concealing their illegal entry into an apartment containing drugs in June 2017. The officers were accused of forging an incident report to cover up the unit's warrantless search of a home. The scandal led to the disbanding of the city's undercover drug unit.
A four-member panel of current and former state controllers tasked with deciding whether New York's 213 lawmakers, statewide elected officials, and more than 100 State Department heads get a pay raise held their first meeting on Tuesday. They have until December 10th to decide whether or not to raise the salary of state lawmakers, already the third highest in the country. Any pay raise would take effect without the need for the state legislature to take a vote. The panel would act even though the state constitution bars the compensation for lawmakers to be raised after they have been elected.
Governor Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that they had given a $3 billion package of tax incentives to have Amazon locate one of its two national headquarters in Long Island City in Queens. The announcement was criticized by community residents who worry about the impact on local stores and by taxpayers who argue that there are better ways to invest billions of dollars in economic development, starting with the crumbling New York City subway system. The deal would circumvent the city council's normal review process.
$372 million in assistance is available to help older adults and low and middle income New Yorkers heat their homes this winter. Applications for the Home Energy Assistance Program are being accepted by local departments of social services. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
We start our show tonight talking with Dr. Ed Landing about his model of climate change that predicts that climate-caused problems are actually underestimated as global warming will accelerate in the near future. Paleontology is the study of ancient life. Dr. Landing was a New York State paleontologist for over 30 years.
Dr. Landing, how did you get involved in paleontology?
These things are always difficult to answer. I think it's a matter of luck and mentoring. And of all things, the New York State Museum and the Milwaukee Museum. I was born in Milwaukee, grew up a little bit to the north, and we had relatives in this area. We'd come to this area, go to John Boyd Thatcher Park, and the interesting thing for a little kid was seeing marine fossils, marine animals in the rocks. And you're seeing something that proves to you that the Earth has really changed. And so I think I just went from archaeology, finding out that part of the past to something to working with deep time. And I would say that something like the New York State Museum, which I visited as a kid while visiting this state, and it's Don Fisher, he was truly a mentor to a little kid.
Yep. So why is paleontology important to people?
Well, I think, you know, early on, let's say the end of the 1700s, it was very important because engineers could recognize, well, this is probably an area where you would want to search for coal based on the types of fossils or different types of iron ore. This is still a reason for a lot of majors in the science. But really, paleo led a cultural change. You know, beginning in the 1800s, everyone is a creationist, but they're faced with a changing world. They're seeing that where they live was once covered by seas, that there is some succession of ancient life, and an idea of deep time was developing. It was still pretty much economic, but I think it really changes with Darwin. And Darwin's 1859 work meant that the rock record is showing something that wouldn't have been allowed by creation. It showed extinction of animals. It shows a succession of organisms and a deep time. And I think today it's particularly important because we're starting to understand how major extinctions took place in the past. We're seeing extinctions related to ice ages, meaning great habitat change, and times when there's an awful lot of carbon dioxide that is produced from volcanoes. And I think the other thing is that we're coming to understand the end of the Pleistocene and the loss of these great big charismatic animals as human-caused. And this is continuing today. We're having a lot of large animals that are going extinct, and so I think we see that humans are becoming a dominant biological organism on Earth.
Now, you used the expression deep time. Could you explain what that means? Does it mean simply more that the Earth is older than 6,000 years old?
Or? Well, this is really the case. I mean, they're starting to suspect something like this, you know, certainly in the 1800s, and it's really only with someone like Marie Curie discovering radiation and the decay of radioactive elements that we start putting a real quantitative time scale onto anything. You know, and really when I look at paleo, I think the worst of paleo is the tagging and description of ancient life. That's collecting. That makes newspaper headlines, you know, a great big new dinosaur from somewhere, but that strips out the science of paleontology. And I found that as I got more and more into paleo that it's important to reconstruct the ancient physical environment that critters were living in, the ecology of associated fossil things, like who produced what, who ate what, who cleaned up the debris. And what the State Museum, when I came there finally, allowed me to do was to do a lot of work in New York State and internationally, a lot of times with federal grants. And what I found in eastern New York, and this is important, were unseen and unrecognized ties between ancient shallow water rocks that you see on the east side of the Hudson and with the slates in the Taconic Hills. And I could recognize that about in excess of 500 million years ago, there were 4 to 5 million year alternations of sea level rise that are recorded in the shallow rocks. And those times of sea level rise extended all the way into Wisconsin. I could recognize them internationally. And these times of sea level rise alternate with sea level fall. And what I could do using fossils was to really precisely correlate sea level rise with extremely low oxygen intervals in the Taconic muds, which means black shales, which meant high sea levels, low oxygen in the ocean, and other workers had been pointing out that these times of high sea levels are times of maximum temperature on Earth. This is something, an unrecognized relationship of sea level and global temperature, which I say in the future is going to be worse than carbon dioxide.
time goes really fast on radio. So the IPCC recently said we had 12 years to take dramatic worldwide action to avoid catastrophic climate change. So I believe what you're talking about was this issue of global hyperwarming impact. How does that impact upon the time assessment that the IPCC says we got left to deal with?
Well, okay, you know, something like this, what I'm saying then is that as Antarctica melts, mountain glaciers melt, and we have melting of all ice on land, sea level is rising. And we know that at present. And what is going to happen as sea level rises is that you got to think of something kind of complex. There's something called albedo, which is reflectance of heat and light from space. And you have insulation. Cover continents with shallow seawater. That shallow seawater heats up, and it makes the world a lot warmer. And that's what we're facing probably within the next 1,000 years. So we're going to complement atmospheric carbon dioxide rise with a heating effect of rising sea levels. This will accelerate what we call global warming.
Is that what you also call global hyperwarming?
I call it hyperwarming because, you know, we talk of the greenhouse environment, and the greenhouse environment is specifically related to, for a generation, to increases in carbon dioxide and other gases like this, greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. What I'm talking about with global hyperwarming is the effect of sea level rise that's taking place right now. And I would say, given some work that they've done in the Arctic with an ice-free Arctic, a third of our climate temperature rise now is due to an ice-free Arctic, due to the heat building up on Earth there. And let heat build up on Earth across all the continents. We're going to accelerate global warming.
So how are you going about... Did I jump ahead? Was your question?
No.
So how are you going about developing the proposal of global hyperwarming, and how do you expect your findings will impact on what we need to do to deal with climate change?
Okay, you know, you go from, in science, from speculation. You observe something, you try to explain it. When you see the same thing happening over and over, you give an explanation, which is called a hypothesis. In science, there's a way to also to test that hypothesis, which is by quantitative models. And I believe I have found someone who's going to work a computer-based model of what happens when you have global sea level rise on a simulated Earth as that water goes across continents. That would be a first test of what happens.
And how do your findings impact on what we need to do with climate change?
Well, I think that what we really have to do is say that here's another effect that is going to take place. But the key thing I think that people have to do is be able to talk about climate change scientifically. What is the evidence? I think we have to say that it isn't a matter of belief. Very frequently they'll say, "Do you believe in climate change?" And I would end up saying, "No, I don't believe in climate change. The evidence is there." Scientifically, belief is good for politics. It's good for religion, and those are respectable ways of thought. And science, this deductive approach, is something that we also have to respect. And I think we've got to understand climate change is taking place, and maybe what we can do. But the key thing is to understand and also be able to talk, you know, with some sense of education about it.
So believe it or not, Dr. Landon, we're out of time.
Oh.
If people want to find out more about your write-ins, where can they go and follow you into this a little bit more?
Yeah, you can Google my name you can just Google my name. You'll find hyperwarming there, a link to this early paper of 2012. There's a 2018 paper. And another thing to do is there's a thing called ResearchGate. You can get on Google. You go to ResearchGate, Ed Landing, and you'll be able to read everything that I've written, including an awful lot of stuff on Eastern New York. Hope you find it interesting.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. We're joined now by Sarah Palmer. On Thursday in Troy, a coalition...
capital gains taxes. It would make sure that there were no out-of-network costs, so everything would be in network, and it wouldn't just be medical insurance. I mean, because, you know, treating the human body, we have teeth and eyes, so it would be medical, dental, vision, lower prescription drug costs, durable medical equipment. I mean, everything combined to the system, as well as you wouldn't necessarily have to be a citizen of the United States. Just if you were a resident of New York State, based on your income, you would have health care coverage.
Could you tell us some of the groups that will be participating in the picket on Thursday in Troy?
Yes. Democratic Socialists of America will be there from New York City and the Capital District, as well as the New York State Nurses Association, and some other progressive groups that will be lining up, and activists. But those are the two main ones.
Where exactly is the picket, and what time?
It is at noon, and it is at 3 p.m. at the Hilton Garden Inn in Troy.
And is that the one pretty close to the Uncle Sam Mall, the atrium area?
I believe that it is, yes.
Okay. So I know that the New York Health Act, the single-payer program, has passed in New York State Assembly for 4 years in a row, but not in the Senate, even though almost a majority of the Senate have been co-sponsors. Now that the Democrats have a strong majority in the Senate for 2019, what is the likelihood that we're going to get this thing passed?
I'm not sure what the likelihood would be in this next session, to be honest, but at least we will have the opportunity to do more lobbying and then hold those who, you know, already co-sponsor the legislation accountable and to see where they're at, especially since we have a Democratic majority now and also gaining the support of the newly elected senators. So, I mean, it could be possible, but we'll have to wait and see what happens.
And the governor, of course, would have to sign off on it. Where does he stand on it, on single payer?
Well, the thing with him, as we've noticed, you know, earlier on, after, you know, the 2016 presidential campaign, he started saying, you know, healthcare is a human right, and following along, riding the Bernie wave. And then most recently, over the past year, he has said that he believes it should be done at a federal level. However, if the rumor is true that he does in fact plan on running for president of the United States, I mean, it would be in his best interest, to pass the New York Health Act and implement single payer here. That way, he has some clout when he runs, if he runs, I should say, as president of the United States, to be able to say, "Hey, we did this in New York and it worked."
Do you have any explanation for his apparent backpedaling?
I do not have an explanation. I mean, one can...
Oh, share us your real thoughts. Who's
listening?
One can listening?
Think that maybe the donors might be insurance companies. I mean, that would be the, you know, implied reason as to why someone might backpedal.
So one of the main arguments against single payer, even though it... You know, lowers overall health care costs. I think a Friedman study was talking about maybe in the $45 billion annual range. It does increase state taxes technically, since you're now putting all of health care costs will be paid out of the state budget. How do you deal with that tax increase issue, and especially of light of the new Senate Majority Leader, presumably Andrea Stewart-Cousins, saying that they are not going to be tax and spend Democrats in the Senate this year?
Well, the other thing you have to look at, I mean, granted, you know, statewide tax, you know, but the property taxes in each county would actually decrease. So that is another avenue to kind of go with, especially when they talk about taxes and the raising of taxes. Each county, like the property taxes that people pay actually go towards the Medicaid in the state. So that would actually lower taxes countywide. I mean, that would be the argument that I would use against that pushback.
Hmm. Can you explain how our listeners might be able to aid you in your efforts?
Might be able to what? Excuse me?
Aid you in your efforts to get this bill passed.
Help out.
Yes. You could visit the Campaign for New York Health Act website at www.nyhcampaign.org. You can look up your state senator and call them and ask them to pass the New York Health Act. And you can do letters, to the editor. Start if you don't have a regular meeting going on in your area, you can contact the campaign and we can start organizing regular general meetings to gear everybody up, because we really plan on doing a lot more lobbying this year in the state Senate and the assembly, more than we have, you know, the previous years. We've done the bigger lobby day, but this time we're actually going to be lobbying. Like, this action tomorrow is the first action to kick off in a series of actions throughout the next legislative session.
Now, if I understood you correctly, you said it's going to be at 12 and 3, so are there like two separate pickets?
Yeah, we're doing, well, one, it's going to be very cold tomorrow, and then we figured that would be, you know, the best time if someone was on their lunch break or maybe people... because the conference actually ends at 4, so we wanted to be out there as they leave to hold up the signs and show the, you know, insurance industry that the people don't believe their lies and that we want New York Health Act and single payer in New York State.
So, Sarah, we're about out of time, so whatever you need to finish, you can put into this last question. But, you know, are there any particular representatives here in the Capital District who have not yet, you know, signed off to single payer that perhaps people might want to touch base with?
To be honest with you, I would have to research that a little bit more, because I just came from Buffalo recently, so I'm not too keen on the Capital District, but I can tell you that the Albany County Legislature signed a proclamation in May with 22 signatures supporting the New York Health Act, and in June, just before Lobby Day, the Albany Common Council passed a resolution overwhelmingly with all the councilmen supporting the New York Health Act.
So, I mean, obviously, just in the Capital District, I know that we just elected, I think, both the state assembly person for the first time here in Rensselaer County. And then certainly the state Senate replacing Senator Marchion. So there might be a couple places people might want to go. But Sarah, we want to thank you for taking our time to join us today.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
For those roasting their chestnuts over an open fire tonight for warmth, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sweet tenderloin for Herschel, our canine mascot, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
So the New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG, is celebrating its 45th anniversary this week. In fact, on Thursday night, it's a big celebration in New York City. I was one of the co-founders of NYPIRG when I was a student at RPI back in the early 70s. And so I interviewed Blair Horner, the executive director, about what NYPIRG has done over the last 45 years and what they hope to accomplish in the upcoming state legislative session. So we're talking with Blair Horner, Executive Director of NYPIRG, who is celebrating or observing his 45th anniversary shortly. But Blair, now that elections are over with, looks like the Democrats have firm control of the Senate. What are some of your NYPIRG's hopes and expectations for the upcoming session?
Well, the one thing that's changed now in Albany is that the era of finger-pointing and blaming the other political party now has passed. And there are a number of issues that have been jammed up for whatever reason over the many years that we've been working here that now have an opportunity for things to happen. So I expect that there'll be a package of voting reforms that will pass. What will be in them is still not clear. Who will chair the relevant committees? We don't know. But I think it's pretty clear that the Senate Democrats in particular want to move a package of bills. They made a big deal out of it in the last couple of years. And it's certainly in the party's interest to make it easier for people to vote in a state that's increasingly blue, moving to cobalt blue the way it's looking. So I expect that there will be something there. There's been a lot of discussion about closing the limited liability company loophole, which allows LLC businesses to make huge campaign contributions as compared to other businesses. In the past, Democrats have said they supported public financing, voluntary system of public financing of elections, but I haven't heard much talk about that since they took over, so we'll see. But I think in the campaign finance area, closing the limited liability company loophole is one place that they will go. There's been a lot about talk about ethics, but it's all been vague. There was very little talked about in terms of the environment, so it's not entirely clear what's going to happen there. I mean, the governor, I assume, will continue to do his work on whatever he's doing on climate change. I think the issue of drinking water contamination could be an issue that pops up to the surface as the session rolls on, but there wasn't a lot of talk about it during the campaign. There's a lot of, seems to be a lot of overlap among the leadership on dealing with issues on rent control because the law expires this year, but what they're going to do is unclear. There was a lot of discussion, I think probably unanimity on expanding abortion rights, gun control in particular. And so there's a lot of issues. I think that there'll be a lot of activity in the beginning of this legislative session, particularly depending on what the governor puts in his budget, and that will break the logjam on a lot of different issues. And so, you know, you never, every election, I'm always hopeful. I'm hopeful still.
Now, one of the issues that seems to get a lot more attention since the election was over with, suddenly we've discovered the need to raise the state legislative salaries. And there has been discussions in exchange for that. We perhaps should look at limits on outside income or other ways to make sure that we're not doing so much outside influence on legislators. What do you think some of those issues should be tied to any legislative pay increase?
Well, you know, we're a little cautious about linking pay increases to anything. I mean, the problem you have with executive and legislative compensation is it's always done as part of some sort of political deal and not what is real, what is a reasonable thing for them. We believe there should be an independent commission that has no ties to the governor and the legislature to figure out what's an appropriate level of compensation. If you look at the data now, New York has the third highest paid governor in the country. It has the third highest base salary for legislatures of any legislature of anywhere in the country. And on top of it, New York has a very generous stipend program where virtually, I believe, every senator is eligible for a stipend from anywhere to $9,000 to $41,500 more than the base salary of $79,500. In the Assembly, all the Assembly Republicans get a stipend or are eligible for a stipend. And a majority, although not all, of the Assembly Democrats. So what's the right way to do that is an interesting question. I think it should be tied, if anything, to reforming the system where you're allowed to get a $41,000 stipend on top of a $79,000 salary. The governor's raised the issue of limiting outside income. The vast majority of members in both houses either have no outside reported income or very little, roughly 40. We looked at this, put out something this morning, 44 out of 63 senators have either no or a little outside income. And 106 of the 150 state assembly members have no or very little outside reported income. So it's, I mean, the outside income issue, I think, is legitimate. We support limits on outside income because when you're an elected official, you should serve one master, not two. But the impact would be somewhat limited since the vast majority of lawmakers don't do it. And then sort of the devil depends on the details. So lawmakers haven't had a pay raise in 20 years. From our view, whatever the adequate compensation level should be set by people who do not have a stake in the outcome. And that's the problem that we have right now. And so we'll see what happens.
Now, you mentioned that the environment didn't get much attention during the recent, at least state-level races.
Other than comptroller.
You know, one of the issues that NYPERG and others had worked on had been the issue of trying to limit plastic bags or ban plastic bags, and that was an issue that the governor and the legislature had overrode the New York City bill that it took 5 years to pass. What thoughts do you have on the plastic bag issue or
other key environmental issues?
Well, to me, I mean, you know, when you look at the issues, I mean, on the plastic bag stuff, there was no real movement on it last year. Whether or not that changes in the Senate is unclear. The key individual who really led the charge to get rid of the New York City law, although allowed all the other localities to have laws, was State Senator from Brooklyn, Simca Felder, who was the sort of the key guy in the Senate, the kingmaker. He's now not the kingmaker since the Democrats have 39 votes, and if Felder joins them, they'll have 40, which is the biggest Senate majority for any political party in decades. So whether or not he plays that same role is unclear, but the big issues are climate change and drinking water, in our view, and climate change is a function of energy policy and how much the state helps to make solar power work better. I mean, there's been a collapse in the commercial solar market on Long Island because of changes the Cuomo administration has made in terms of how they get paid. The state should clean up its act to make sure we are getting the biggest amount of clean energy possible. And I think the state needs to do more to ensure that the drinking water supplies and surface freshwater supplies are protected both from climate change and industrial legacy. And that's going to cost bucks. And so I think that those two issues are going to be big issues for the upcoming session. What happens with plastics, certainly a legitimate garbage-related issue. By the way, I would argue that solid waste may turn out to be a big issue because China stops being our garbage landfill now. There's a number of big-ticket items on the environmental agenda that will have to be addressed.
Well, one of those issues which NYPERG has really been famous for decades has been the issue of the New York City's subways with the strap hangers campaign. Everybody says we need to fix the subways, a big ticket item. What is NYPERG hoping to see?
Well, I mean, you got to come up with new money. I mean, the state's facing a budget deficit for the upcoming fiscal year. We just talked about drinking water needs. We talked, which is really state money. There are going to be a whole host of other issues that are going to have some costs associated with them. And you're right, the mass transit system in the city of New York and the commuter rails are a serious problem downstate. And that's a big energy issue. It's a big climate change issue because if people are moving around the city in cars, that's bad for the environment and it's bad for people's lungs and the congestion of the city itself. So I think they're going to have to come up with a new funding source. It seems like there's some agreement to try to do something about congestion pricing, which is basically putting tolls or some mechanism in place to collect money for people who drive into Manhattan in particular. They're going to have to come up with new money because to fix the subway system is going to cost tens of billions of dollars. The state has kicked the can so long that the bill now has come due. Now, how they're going to do that, with budget deficit and other important financial pressures is still unclear, but I think there's going to be a consensus among the governor and the legislative leaders that they have to do something about mass transit in the city, particularly the MTA, and my guess is that we'll see some version of a new fee of some sort, a tax or a congestion pricing system that has to be put in place to come up with the money.
Now, later this week, NYPERG is having an event in New York City to mark its 45th anniversary. What are some of your, highlights looking back over the last 45 years? And, where does NYPERG go heading forward?
Well, you're right. NYPERG is 45 years old, sort of amazing. The idea was created by a bunch of college students back in the early to mid-1970s. I think one of them I'm looking at right now was involved.
Right. And I remember the first bill we actually passed was a bill on about hearing aids. And so now I can take advantage of that.
That's right. And so, we're having a big event to celebrate our 45th anniversary. We typically do these every 5 years. It's to some extent to help raise money for the issues that we work on. It's also a way for sort of a high school reunion equivalent for the NYPERG generations. Over the many years, I mean, there's lots of legislative initiatives and policy changes that we've worked on. But I think the single biggest testament to our existence has been the fact that we've churned out lots of activists with skills to become successful in the advocacy world and in the citizenship world. That is, I think, our biggest achievement, if you want to call it that. And that's what we're supposed to do. And we're having an event to celebrate that. And to celebrate the work of another organization.
Because of Amazon.
Family Fund. Because really, NYPERG is part of a movement. It's not just one thing all by itself. It's part of a movement that believes that the public interest is best protected when citizens are engaged and fighting for the issues that they care about. And those residents of the state can be old, middle-aged, or young, but it's important to get people educated and organized and engaged in the big policy issues of the year. And we've talked about some of the ones that are coming up.
And people want more information about NYPERG, get involved, how best they do that?
Probably the easiest way is to go to the website, NYPERG, NYPIRG.org, NYPERG.org.
And that's been Blair Horner, Executive Director of NYPERG, and this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
We've been listening to Blair Horner on the 45th anniversary of the New York Public Public Interest Research Group.
Or NYPERG. So, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Andrew Lynn paddled around Eider Lake in Troy, beat us up there on Route 2 by the Stewarts, and spoke to residents about the planned demolition of the dam that created it.
WOOC correspondent Andrew Lynn here. This past Sunday, November 4th, I got a chance to head up to Eider Lake in the east side neighborhood of Troy with my kiddo Hazel Moon. Put our kayak into the water for a bit of a bittersweet adventure. As you'll hear, people had gathered on the lake in boats to paddle around and explore the really amazing ecology up there, ecology that is about to change as the dam that creates the lake is failing and is likely to be removed in the coming weeks. So I'm here with Anasha Cummings, who is in a kayak in the Post and Kill. How you doing today, Anasha?
Hey, Andrew. Doing well. Beautiful day out here on the Post and Kill.
So just describe a little bit where we are and what you know about the potential demolition or changing of the landscape here.
So yeah, we're on the Post and Kill just above the Mount Ida Dam, which creates Belden Pond, also known as Ida Lake. It's a beautiful habitat that's built up over years of the dam being here. But unfortunately, we recently got the news that the dam has cracked in a couple points, and the engineers are concerned about it collapsing with ice flow next year. And so they are going to take some temporary actions to mitigate that, which will result in the draining of the pond for now. We're out here today sort of enjoying and making sure that people are aware of the resource that it provides. With aim towards exploring, whether it's worth the cost of rebuilding that dam, both for the natural habitats that it creates and for the recreational.
Next, I spoke with Mark, who lives just above the dam.
I'm Mark Heffernan. I live on the Post and Kill Creek with my wife Monica, and we just bought this house in April. And I have read the engineering reports that that say that the city has to demolish the dam. And I, having an engineering background myself, I do believe that they do have to do something to relieve the pressure behind the dam, because there is a chance that it would fail in an uncontrolled way, and that would not be good. But the part that I am interested in changing or working with the city is that they have a plan to demolish the dam in the coming weeks, but they have no consequent plan with regard to the ultimate future of this waterway. They don't have plans to rebuild the dam, and amongst plans to possibly rebuild the dam, there is also a thought of allowing the Post and Kill to assume its natural flow, which there's a lot of sentiment about as far as removing dams and allowing rivers to assume their natural flow. But here in an urban center, I have concern about that because this stream, assuming its natural flow, leaves Ida Lake, which is 9 acres of open water, as vacant land. And the concern, there is a concern about potential of development, but also
I think that there is great potential that if this dam is rebuilt in proper way with an adjustable floodgate, that it can be used to modulate the flow of the Postenkill and relieve some of the water in Ida Lake prior to a known storm event. And Ida Lake can function as an important stormwater catchment basin to reduce the flood loads on the lower Postenkill Canal, which would affect hundreds of residents in South Troy and along Ida Street and Canal Street.
Another neighbor, Yael, was present, and she shared some of her thoughts, too.
My name is Yael Erel. I think the main question would be what happens after they figure out the different alternatives. And what's quite shocking to me about this this part of the city is that you're probably a minute away from traffic, and you're deep in nature. You're in immersed in an ecosystem that's unbelievable. You can just paddle for a minute, and you're in Wonderland. And that's just such a unique moment. I haven't seen it anywhere that I've lived before.
Thanks for listening. So that was a few voices from the flotilla of sorts that explored Ida Lake on Sunday, November 4th. I want to thank Mark and Monica for being gracious hosts. They had some snacks out for people who were boating around the lake, and everyone who turned out. It was a really cool exploration, and we'll see what happens in the coming weeks. If you are concerned or have strong opinions about these matters, you should check out what's going on. I think there's some information on the city website, and look out for any upcoming meetings where you might want to make your voice heard. Once again, this is Andrew Lynn for WOOC in Troy, New York.
That was Andy Lynn with a piece on the Ida Lake Dam. For your information, Andy is affiliated with the Troy Bike Rescue Project and is also an RPI alumnus.
And I want to give a little shout out to Capital District Solidarity Committee, which is celebrating its 35th anniversary. You know, they actually was started 35 years ago, believe it or not, providing labor support for the Greyhound bus drivers when they went out on strike. And 35 years later, they're still going strong. But what has happened, all these militant trade unionists are now like the head of the Albany Central Labor Council and the Troy Area Labor Council. So the radicals have become the leaders of the local labor movement. So that's good to see. We're going to finish up with a segment from Dave Pablo as part of our farm bucket. We were hoping to get Willie Terry on to talk about Veterans Day talk by SUNY Albany Professor Oscar Williams on the history of African Americans in the U.S. military from the Revolutionary period up to the World War II, and he had taped that as part of Veterans Day. But we'll get to Willie another day, hopefully this week. But Dave explores what's going on with the issue of where to put the Troy Farmers Market along with the development of the Troy Monument Square area.
On Wednesday, November 7th, the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market held a community workshop led by Project for Public Space at the Franklin Plaza Ballroom in 4th Street in downtown Troy. Project for Public Spaces gave a presentation focusing on many of the different types of farmers markets around the world that had similarities to Troy, to give an idea of some of the possibilities in one Monument Square or elsewhere in the city. I had a chance to talk with four of the key people in this debate, and that is what follows.
I'm Zach Metzger. I'm the president of the board for the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market. And tonight we were here at Franklin Plaza Ballroom to sort of explore some of the future possibilities of the market with a group called the Project for Public Spaces. They're a nonprofit with a focus of strengthening communities through public spaces, farmers market being one of those that they are helping us and helping with across the country and throughout the world.
Where does this project stand at this point? Are we still hearing from just multiple voices to get an idea of what is out there conceptually, or are we getting closer to some action being taken?
Well, so where we're at right now is, you know, there are a lot of really wonderful possibilities for the market around the city of Troy in terms of a potential longer-term home. Right now, we're really fortunate to have the atrium as a wonderful place for our winter market. And I think with the attached parking garage, it's been one of our hugest, the biggest boons we've had as a market, a wonderful indoor space and good parking. The street level in Troy has also been wonderful through the summertime, and we're seeing some huge markets and wonderful success for our vendors, who are really happy with the results of a lot of years of hard work. And so I think right now the question for us as a board and as a market is, what do we do now? You know, things are really good. Things are going well for us. What's next? What's the best move forward? And one of the answers and one of the thoughts is to pursue a permanent home for the market. Somewhere maybe in the summertime we could go into in inclement weather. One Monument Square has recently been talked about a lot, and the market has been a wonderful part of that conversation. The atrium is also considering some major changes, and that's a place that we would consider a possibility for us. So kind of the sky feels like the limit from where I'm at. And in a city like Troy that is just changing dramatically, and the entire makeup of the city is changing in the past 5 years, and we don't know where the next 5 years will take us. So we really have to take pause and think through what we could do moving into the future and how we can be part of the community.
Next is Seth Jacobs, owner of Slack Hollow Farm in Argyle.
Well, as a vendor, I need some shelter from the elements, and I need consistency of sales. And like, for example, we just had two extremely cold, rainy markets. The last outdoor market was outdoors, and then the next indoor, the next market was in the atrium. And my sales were, even though the day was the same, were twice what they were when I was indoors as when I was outdoors. And we also had a summer where we had at least five rainy markets. And these are big hits to my income. It's a business plan that depends on the weather is a tough way to go. As a farmer, my back's already to the wall with the elements on the production end. And I just don't need that on the sales side.
Just a minute ago, I'd asked you about what you were looking for in a market in terms of like the indoor-outdoor structure of it. Do you have a perfect market in mind?
There's many examples I would want to follow, but what I have in mind is a good gathering place that works in all weather. And as you saw in this presentation, the number one priority for communities and for the public is a place to gather, a place that brings people together. And any picture of the Troy Market on a stormy, rainy day doesn't meet that criteria.
Now, you had said to me earlier that the statement that the mayor made at the beginning of this was the strongest, clearest statement of support that you'd heard yet. Do you have an impression about where this goes from here?
I think a city like Troy, which has its backs to the wall in terms of revenue and infrastructure needs, I think the impetus for a project like this is going to have to come from the market. It could very well be in partnership with the city, but this isn't a case where we need to look to an outside developer, which is a model which hasn't worked, say, for a place like Monument Square, which is one of the top candidates for a market site. I think this needs to be a Troy market city-driven effort.
My name is Anasha Cummings. I'm a representative on the Troy City Council, representing downtown Troy, a bit of RPI and a bit of the Hillside, which obviously sees the farmers market as its center every Saturday.
And what did you think of tonight's presentation?
I think it was a fine way to start the discussion. This is a discussion that's sort of been in the ether for a while, and I think it's important to bring people out and start getting it out on paper, getting it out in words and in language to start thinking about what's next for the market, if anything, and what people like about the existing market. I'm looking forward to reading all the little post-it notes people put around to see what's coming from the room. I think, obviously, the presenters today are very knowledgeable and have worked on these projects in a lot of other places, so they have some expertise to share with us, although Troy is obviously a unique place with unique challenges and unique assets. And so it'll be interesting to see how we create something unique for our city.
Do you have a sense of the likelihood that the market will stay tied to the Monument Square area?
No. I don't really have a sense of where that partnership is at this point. I think certainly the market doesn't want to put all its eggs in that basket. I think there are a few possible locations. I know that there is other existing plans around the atrium as well and how that will change. And so there's some pressure to figure out whether or not their future is in a partnership in helping do that or in creating a new space in Monument Square or, I mean, I suppose there are probably other options as well. I think certainly there's a broad consensus that people like having it in the streets of Troy, but in the winter it gets a little cold in the streets of Troy, so we do need somewhere with a big indoor space for them to continue to be a 12-season or 12-month market.
And do you have a sense of the timetable at this point, how quickly this is going to develop?
No, this is just starting. Certainly you could see whether any of the board members of the farmers market have a sense of their timeline, but my sense is that all the projects involved are nebulous in their time frames, somewhere between 3 and 50 years. But obviously, we continue to have a great market in the meantime.
And do you know anything about funding that's available for this project at this point?
So for Monument Square in particular, there is still $3 million of funding from the state to help with some of the infrastructure. We saw some initial plans around that on Monday, but I don't know what sorts of funding will be available for a market in particular. I think we basically would be going after various state CFA applications.
My name is David O'Neill. I'm with the Project for Public Spaces.
And you presented today. Tell me a little bit about what the presentation was about.
It was a general presentation about markets, the types of markets, the benefits of markets, what makes markets successful, and some case studies of markets that have some similarities to what Troy is thinking about.
Can I ask who hired you for this particular job?
The market hired us.
And were there specific goals that they put in front of you that they were trying to reach?
I would say not specific goals. I would say they were more general goals. I mean, a group of them just came down and took our training course that we do twice a year in New York, a little more intensive. And they realized that they might benefit from some outside help from people that have done this a few times. And so I think we're looking at the big picture right here. We're not looking at a specific site. We're looking at their capacity and their opportunities moving ahead to become more permanent, but also to preserve that sort of indescribable market culture that they don't want to lose.
I've been following this issue for some time, and I know that, especially for a lot of the businesses in Monument Square, they look at the Troy Farmers Market as kind of a golden basket of sorts, and they want to have it fit in a certain way. So many of them are concerned about the idea that this might shift to a different part of the city. Do you have a sense of other locations where this might go?
Oh, I think it's too early for us to be putting ourselves in that position. That was too presumptuous for us. But we're certainly looking around and like maybe asking questions like, what about this or what about that? Or, you know, looking at downtown.
And you had cited in your presentation different markets that I guess that you've been involved with around the world. What are some of the common elements in those markets that you see in Troy?
The dynamics of a market are really the same wherever you are. And you obviously have an excellent market here. They're very successful, and they want to be more secure in their future. So there are some issues that we were talking about in the presentation in terms of finances, in terms of management, the role of the city, the role of the market, and looking at options. We're not here to say you should do it like this or like that, but to understand your assets and maybe the best way to organize and work with what you have.
Speaking of which, I've lived in a number of places. I've lived in Boston, I've lived in Seattle, so I have some direct experience with those markets. Do you have a sense of the price tag for putting in a market of that sort?
Well, you know, a shed costs X. A building is, you know, X times 5 or 10 from a shed, and so you can really run up and down the ladder. And we would prefer not to spend that much money. One of the examples that we showed was in Grand Rapids, and that shed, I don't know, I think it was, you know, a million-ish, something like that. And then there was another new market that they just built across town that was like $30 or $40 million, and it's won awards, and they had a beautiful place for the farmers, and but the farmers have all left, and it's like too upscale, and people didn't cotton to it. And the other market that spent much less money is much happier. They're much more stable, and they're doing much more business. So it's not really about spending money. It's how do you grow and preserve the culture at the same time, and not lose the culture, not extend it or stretch it too much. It sort of needs to catch up with itself while it grows.
You had some admiring comments to make about the city. Are you going to be spending more time in Troy to get a sense of maybe existing structures that might fit the bill?
Yeah, we've been walking around, we've been driving around, and the city has a good feel. I mean, you just turn a corner and there's something else interesting. You turn and there's an alley and someone's saying, oh, well, this alley, it's not going to be all trash. We're going to be taking it out and turn it into a laneway. And there's so many interesting things going on downtown. We talk about the power of 10, that you need like 10 things to get the synergy going. Well, you've got a lot more. You're beyond that already in Troy.
For our listeners, if they wanted to get a sense of other projects that you guys have worked on, is there a website or some other location they could go to?
www.pps.org. That's P as in Peter, P as in Peter, S as in Sam.
Great. Thank you very much.
Hey, Dave.
Clearly, plans for this development are starting to take shape. Farmers have a clearer vision than they've ever had, and they seem to have a working relationship with the mayor's office. As Anasha Cummings said, there appears to be $3 million available, and as David O'Neill said, it's possible that a project could go for as little as $1 million. We will follow this issue going into the future. I'm Dave Pablo for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And that was another one of our farm segments here on WOOC with Dave Pablo. And that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Our engineer tonight is Jack Massaroni. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, believe it or not, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meet-ins on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in beautiful North Central Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.